Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Millennials, Americans born in the last decades of the 20th century, have the lowest levels of religious affiliation of any generation of Americans since the 19th century. Houses of worship are closing and merging, and a variety of American denominations are thinking about what the rest of the 21st century holds. Why choose a career, then, in the church, the synagogue, the mosque? This hour, On Point, Millennial Clergy and Redefining American Faith. You can join us on air and online. Have you seen a decline in attendance at your house of worship? Are you worried about the declining role of religion in your community? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Emma Green, politics, policy, and religion staff writer at The Atlantic. She's profiled millennial priests in her writing, which you can find at our website, onpointradio.org. Welcome to On Point, Emma.
Thanks so much for having me.
What do the numbers tell us? Do America's Catholic congregations have enough shepherds for the flock?
Well, in general, no, they don't. Many American dioceses, which are the system of organization for the American church, are missing priests. This could be because they had a pastor who died or they haven't been able to backfill some sort of personnel move. But in general, the numbers have been on a steady decline over the years since the 1960s in particular, when there was a surge in interest in new vocations or new roles in the church. In the class of 2016, the U.S. Catholic Church had roughly about 550, something like that, people who were ordained as priests. And this was down since previous years. This is something that within the church itself, many people are worried about because they look to the future, they play out the numbers, and they don't see something good.
You know, a lot of people may not understand. Roman Catholics in the United States are the largest single religious body in the country. Estimates run as high as 75 million Americans. And Catholic churches are quite large and often only have one priest. And we're talking about one priest for 5,000 and 6,000 people. You can't possibly know them all. It must be really a hard job.
Certainly. And this is something that a lot of dioceses and parishes are thinking about creatively. So, for example, in Chicago, they're going through a realignment effort right now, trying to both save money and resources, but also solve the problem you're talking about, that there are priests who are hopping back and forth from 3 and 4 churches every Sunday just to try to perform mass for different communities. So it's something that many parishes and dioceses are grappling with. And there's not always a clear solution to how to get priests to know the people who they're actually tending.
Do we know enough about the causes? If you visit a seminary, if you visit many Catholic institutions of higher ed, you'll see seminary classes from the 50s and 60s, huge groups of smiling, optimistic young men in black cassocks getting ready to head out into the national church. And a lot of those seminaries aren't even open, and the classes are, by comparison, tiny. What was pressing on Catholic American men to cause that change?
Well, certainly we can't discount the population of young people who are choosing to go to seminary or who are on the path to ordination. And then on the female side, young women religious who are deciding whether they might have a vocation to be a consecrated virgin or to be a nun. These are people who have real experiences, who are really attracted to that rich life. But in general, I think there are a lot of cultural factors that have chipped away at the numbers there and have made that a less attractive path. I think one is the general secularization of American society, fewer people growing up in that rich and dedicated Catholic context or more generally growing up religious. And second, there's something about becoming a priest or a nun or someone who's in religious life, which is pretty deeply countercultural. It's not the same as going to law school and getting a fancy job. It's not the same as having a nice house in the suburbs where you can have a big TV. You're dedicating yourself to a life of poverty and obedience and faith. And this is something that I think it really takes a strong kind of character, someone who's willing to go against big cultural trends to pursue that as your life.
Briefly, before I let you go, Emma, as I've moved around and met Catholic clerics, I'm finding a lot more of them are from sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America, two big heartlands of worldwide Catholicism. Can the American church rely on that emergency supply for much longer?
Emergency supply is a great phrase for that, because I do think that on the one hand, the American church has to rely on these clerics who are coming from elsewhere in the world. Unlike in the United States, Catholicism in Africa is booming. Catholicism in Latin America is troubled in its own way, but also is pretty vibrant. So this isn't something that the American church really has a choice in. But I do think that question of an emergency is really relevant here. It's a little bit of a crisis for the American church that we are looking outside of our own country borders to find the most vibrant examples of Catholic life. And I do think many people within the American hierarchy are troubled by the fact that they're not able to grow their own ranks of young people who are looking to lead flocks in the United States.
Emma Green writes about politics, policy, and religion at The Atlantic. Great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joining us now from Orlando, Florida, where he's attending the National Black Catholic Congress, is Father Matt O'Donnell. He's a 30-year-old Catholic priest from St. Columbanus in Chicago. Just a year after he was ordained at age 26, Father O'Donnell got the job to lead a predominantly African-American parish in the south side of Chicago. Father O'Donnell, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about your own decision-making process. As a teenager, as a collegian, what attracted you to the life of a Catholic priest? Emma Green suggested, did the choice appear to your friends, to your family, to people who knew you growing up, to be countercultural?
It was definitely a countercultural choice. I grew up in a family that was Catholic. In fact, we lived directly next door to the church, and our next door neighbor was our parish priest. And so even though I grew up in the parish and was deeply involved, and my dad was ordained a deacon for the Catholic Church in 2006, the decision to actually go to the seminary was something that I struggled with for many years. And a lot of my friends didn't really understand why I would choose such a life, you know, not being able to get married, not having a family, not really making a whole lot of money. So it just was something that didn't make a lot of sense to people.
And now you've been ordained for a few years. You're still young in your career. Have there been surprises? Is it what you expected? Have there been some things that are, in fact, harder than you were led to expect?
I think everything about priesthood has been surprising in a very good way. And I think the people who didn't understand why I wanted to be a priest, they see now how happy I am, how fulfilled I am, how joyful I am in my ministry. And I think the part that's been most surprising for me is just being with people each and every day means that every day is something new. And so the seminary does a great job preparing us as parish priests to know our theology, to know our history, to know how to celebrate the sacraments. But then when we're with people on a daily basis, everything's new every day.
Is there a higher threshold than there might have been in your father's day, in your grandfather's day? The filters,
I think there absolutely
the filters
is.
That the seminary, the impediments that the seminary puts in your way as far as your own discernment, as far as knowing whether this is a commitment you actually want to make. Did you have to go through a battery of, psychological tests, for instance?
So the first thing you do when you apply to the seminary, after you meet with the seminary faculty, the rector, is that you do go through psychological testing. So different battery of tests to make sure that you're psychologically sound to enter into the seminary. And then all throughout the process, there's lots of formation and there's lots of moments when you're evaluated by your peers. You're evaluated by your formators, the priests and the lay people that are on faculty at the seminary. And then ultimately, before your ordination, you're called to orders by your local bishop, who takes all of that into account before allowing you to be ordained. So I think today in the church in the United States, there's lots of checks and balances. There's lots of accountability. And there is higher expectations for the men who are being ordained to the priesthood today.
since, as I mentioned, you work in an African-American parish in a black part of Chicago, this is not and hasn't been a natural Catholic territory. Do you have to take an old-fashioned parish boundary view of your work and minister to people who may never even come to your church?
So in Chicago, black Catholics have been a part of the archdiocese and foundational to the archdiocese from its inception back in the 1800s. And today, the neighborhood where we are, it's called Park Manor, there's not a lot of Catholics. And so the people that live in our neighborhood, they're moving out. The neighborhood's not Catholic. So my ministry as a Catholic priest extends beyond the people who come on a Sunday morning. We have a food pantry where we serve over 500 residents every week. We have an athletic center that has over 900 kids in our basketball league. We have a parish school where 80% of the kids are not Catholic. And so our ministry and our mission at the parish goes well beyond those who come on Sunday morning or those who claim themselves to be Catholic.
Father O'Donnell, stay with us. We're discussing why American religion is on the decline and how millennial clergy may be redefining spirituality for a changing country. After the break, we'll be joined by a young rabbi and an Episcopal priest. We head into the break with REM's Losing My Religion. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with millennial religious leaders about the challenge of reaching a less religious nation. You can join the conversation. Where do you find community? A house of worship? Soul Cycle? Already with us, Father Matt O'Donnell, a 30-year-old Catholic priest. Joining us now from Detroit, Michigan, Alana Alpert, a 34-year-old rabbi at a Reconstructionist congregation, Techia, and director of Detroit Jews for Justice, a community-based organization. Rabbi, welcome.
Thank you.
And joining us from Los Angeles is the Reverend Will Stanley, a 27-year-old Episcopal priest. He's associate for pastoral care at St. Cross Episcopal Church in Hermosa Beach, California. He began working there just last month and prefers that people call him Will. All right. Welcome to the show, Will.
Hi, Ray. Thank you.
The feedback, Rabbi Alpert and Will, is twofold from what I hear. People say, really, when they hear that that's what you have in mind as a life plan. And then some, in a different way, a more concerned way, say, well, are you sure you want to do that, given the way things are going? Alana Alpert, what kind of feedback did you get?
That actually wasn't the conversation that was happening when I entered rabbinical school about 8 years ago. Both my parents are Jewish educators, and I was voted most likely to be a rabbi in fifth grade. So I guess you could say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I think that the community was really supportive, a little bit concerned because they thought of me as very countercultural. So a little bit surprised that I would take that path, but curious and supportive.
Okay. How about you, Will Stanley?
Well, my experience growing up at a large Episcopal church in Washington, D.C. was one of really great support and encouragement. I was lucky to have a really crackerjack youth minister growing up who managed to thread that needle between support and allowing space for a young person to grow and allowed me an opportunity to continue to ask those questions about vocation and meaning and purpose. And I was lucky enough to then go on to schools that provided an environment where I was supported and given, I think, the realistic picture of what the church looks like, that being a clergy person is not always easy, and that it is countercultural in many ways, and that in many ways you could make a lot more money perhaps working not as hard doing other things. And yet, if you find at a young age, as I did, and I think many of us did, something that you really are passionate about and love, there's really not much better thing to discover, even at a young age.
I don't think I'm telling tales out of school. To mention to the audience, I've known the Reverend Will Stanley since he was in kindergarten. And also, I should mention, my daughter is an Episcopal priest, just ordained. And one of the things she told me about her college experience is that there was a kind of new snootiness where people who knew her in one context would say, gee, how could you believe that stuff? You seem so smart. I mean, it went actually beyond the realm of insulting. And even people who knew that about her and knew that she was a religious person wondered about whether there would even be somebody to minister to in the middle years of a career, in the 2030s, in the 2040s. Numbers have to enter into the conversation, don't they, Rabbi Alpert?
Well, yes and no. So numbers in traditional kind of synagogue settings might be dwindling or struggling. But there is all kinds of creative, non-traditional Jewish communities springing up, and more traditional communities that are innovating in specific areas and kind of renewing themselves that way.
Will Stanley?
I certainly think that the religious landscape of denominational identity is rapidly changing. People are far less concerned about being a Methodist or an Episcopalian, at least in the Christian circles, than being a Christian. I just moved from Atlanta, Georgia, which is a cosmopolitan place, but still in the South, to Los Angeles, where being secular is by far the norm. And you really have to, there is an opportunity for all of us in our religious contexts to get very clear about who we are and why we're proclaiming what we're proclaiming, which I think is a very healthy environment for church to constantly reform and get a sense of clarity about why it's here and what role we serve. And I think people are attracted to that kind of authenticity, which in a sense the context now and in the next decades will give us.
Do you worry about who's going to be sitting out there in the pews in 2035?
I would say it's certainly something I think about. I think it's going to look different. You know, most Episcopal churches in my context, the average age is, let's say, a few years higher than 27. And so math works a certain way, and our evangelism efforts and trying to welcome people into our communities are going to have to shift, and they certainly are going to look different. And, you know, anyone who, all of us are doing this in a sense as a career, so we certainly want communities of vitality for to support us in what we're doing. And yet, in other ways, there's all sorts of examples, even in my own context, of places that like that are doing new things and non-traditional forms of ministry that we have to be open to, not just for survival, but in order to thrive, which is ultimately what we're called to do.
Father O'Donnell, how about you? I mean, when you think about the coming decades of your career in a lifelong calling, and you see these troubling numbers about American religious affiliation, where does that leave you?
It leaves me really just focused on our mission as people of faith, that there's always going to be a need in our country, and people will turn to the church, whether or not they're members of the church, to find the support that they need. And especially for me, living on the south side of Chicago, where we have high rates of violence, high rates of poverty and unemployment, you know, we're looking not to be so concerned about who's there on Sunday morning, but about what are we doing in our community to make Chicago a better place. And that mission, no matter how many people are in the pews, is going to continue.
We're going to move on to Burlington, Wisconsin. Tom, welcome to the program.
If priests were allowed to marry, I think it would increase the number of priests we would have, and it would also allow them to get out of the ivory tower attitude they have towards their parishioners. They would be living the life that their parishioners are living. And if for the millennials, when they're watching the one religion tears down another religion, particularly they call people infidels, that we're not infidels, and this destroys the entire the entire number of people who would love religion and respect religion when you see one religion tearing down another religion. And I just wonder if possibly that we could, and it gets into this thing of the terrorism thing, because these people with the terrorists, they call other people, they demonize people, and they are allowed to kill them. And I wonder if maybe we could get some way to get this idea of using infidels by maybe changing the tax codes or something, rather than would penalize some of these religions for.
Well, Tom, you've gotten us pretty far afield here. We began with priestly celibacy and moved on to terrorism and the tax code. Let's start with your first point. And Father Matt, I'm sure this is something that you've heard along the way in your own training, and you mentioned it earlier when we were talking, the role that celibacy may play or may not play in who becomes a Catholic priest.
Celibacy is meant to be a gift that the Church has and the gift that the priest is able to offer to the people. By being celibate, I'm able to be completely focused on my ministry and to the people of St. Columbanus Parish and to the work that I do as a priest. And I think that there is some truth that if priests were able to get married, which is something that may happen down the road, that there could be more men who respond to that call. But I think that celibacy itself is a gift, and that like other Christian traditions, like churches in the East that allow that as an option for the man himself to decide, I think that's something that has great value for the Catholic Church.
Will and Alana, it's not part of your traditions, but one thing that is the idea that you live a model life or a life that can be held up as a positive example to the people in your community. Is there a burden in that when you're 30, when you're 29 years old? Rabbi?
Certainly a burden and a blessing. I think I have to be very intentional about all the choices that I make about how I want to live my life. And at the same time, I'm really interested in breaking down some of the old school barriers they used to talk about clergy as symbolic exemplar. And certainly growing up, my clergy was up on a platform very, very far away from the congregation. I was reading a book that's actually fairly recent with rabbis talking about innovation. And they were saying, one of them was saying, you know, this, I did this really radical thing. I invited members into my home and it just revolutionized our, it just transformed our relationship. And I was cracking up when I was reading it. I was like, really? Like, that's a radical move to make? Because my house is open all the time. It's just full of members of my community in and out for meetings, for conversations, for meals. The thought that I would have some of those boundaries is really foreign to me. And of course, something that I have to be mindful of going a little too extreme in that direction.
Well, Stanley, do you wear clericals when you're out and about in the community, doing your shopping, taking the car to the car wash, just doing ordinary life tasks?
No. I laugh because the parish that I served for the first 2 years of being a priest in Atlanta, Georgia, was a suburban and had a more formal culture, so I wore clericals more often, but only to the office and on Sundays. And now out here in California, wearing clericals, even on Sundays, Sunday is a norm, but other times it's not. And I think there's an interesting balance there. I think there's an argument to be made that wearing clerical garb, signifying your office in a public way, is an interesting way to model and remind folks the church is there. Although my experience, even in Atlanta, where I would stop on an errand after the office, is most people would not recognize the garb and then have associations about all sorts of things, but normally we're just very confused, and that might be the best model for our sort of secular climate.
Well, I'm interested in that answer, because isn't wearing the traditional Roman-style collar, a black shirt, in an area that you earlier mentioned was very secular, a way of showing to the world, hey, look at me, I'm a young fella, I've chosen this life. Think about that for a minute, world.
Absolutely. And there are certainly times where I think I will have it on and will have to be open and would like to be open to conversation. There's plenty. I've gotten all sorts of, almost diagnosed all of the different looks that you might get, from confused to intrigued to some sort of mix of the two. And yet I'm currently serving at a church in a beach community where most people don't even wear a button-down shirt, much less anything more formal than that. So it's sort of it's an interesting metaphor for, I think, ministry in how you navigate your office and your role and all sorts of interesting questions that you have to navigate as a priest of whatever age, but especially if you're in your late 20s, when most of the friends I'm making here in Los Angeles have no church affiliation at all. And at a dinner party, you know, on the 4th of July a couple of days ago, when you go around and say what you do, I would say what I did, and it was somewhat surprising for a lot of people, but then a lot of intrigue came from that. So, good opportunity.
Father Matt?
So for me, it's just really a mix. As I sit here in Orlando, I'm in my clerics because I'm at the National Black Catholic Congress. But if I was in Chicago today, I'd probably be in shorts and a button down because it's hot outside. So, I mean, for me, it's about, you know, being able to be that public witness. And when people see the collar, I agree with Will that it opens the door to lots of conversations and lots of intrigue. And at the same time, I want people to be able to see me as somebody who's normal and like them and relatable. So when I'm with my friends or at the parish or going out, I don't really put a lot of time into thinking about, should I wear my clerics today or should I not? It's just whatever I'm doing is what's going to dictate what I'm wearing.
We've gotten some feedback from listeners. Gordon writes, I'm a 32-year-old pursuing ordination in the Presbyterian Church. The impression I get from my generation regarding their attitude toward religion consists of both burnout and getting burned. By burnout, I mean a life of growing up in a church that now feels boring or disengaged. By burned, I mean being on the wrong end of social issues the church has taken a stance on. Candace writes, I grew up Methodist, converted to Judaism, had a heart-to-heart with my daughter as she prepared for her bas mitzvah, asking to understand our motivation, finally accepted that we just aren't that religious. We don't believe in God, and we don't want to be doing things to keep up a facade. Religion motivates people to do good things, but also really, truly horrible things. We can be good without religion. We miss the community, but are relieved to be our authentic selves. Beth writes, religious affiliation is dwindling for millennials, but spirituality is not. And a listener writes, I'm relieved and encouraged that we're entering an age of reason by leaving superstition and adult fairy tales behind. Interesting mix of responses. Will Stanley is an Episcopal priest at St. Cross Church in Hermosa Beach, California. Great talking to you, Will. Best of luck.
Thank you, Ray.
Rabbi Alpert and Father O'Donnell, stick with us. We're discussing religion, taboos, the changing of religious traditions with our panel of millennial clergy. When we come back from the break, we'll be joined by a young imam. We head to break with Chance the Rapper's Blessings. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
It seems like blessings keep falling in my lap. I don't make songs for free, I make them for freedom. Don't believe in kings, believe in the kingdom. Chisel me into stone prayer, whistle me into song air. Dying laughing with Krillin, saying something about blonde hair. Jesus, black life ain't matter. I know I talked to his daddy. Say you the man of the house now, look out for your family. He has ordered my steps, gave me a sword with a crest, and gave Donnie a trumpet in case I get shortness of breath.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with young clergy and about the challenges of reaching a country that's increasingly less religious and much more preoccupied. You can join the conversation. Is regular attendance at a worship service a priority for you? Is that different from when you were a kid? Does it compete with other things for your time? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Matt O'Donnell, a Catholic priest from Chicago, and Rabbi Alana Alpert from Detroit. Joining us now from Dallas, Texas, is Imam Omar Suleiman, a 30-year-old Muslim cleric and founder and president of the Yaqeen Institute for Islamic Research. Imam Suleiman, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's good to be on.
Are you an American-born person, Imam?
I am, and I get called rabbi too. I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana. So,
because I ask because as I've visited mosques around the country, that seems to be one of the big dividing lines in the clerical ranks. Whether you were born and, in fact, educated and trained overseas, or whether you grew up in an American context and relate to the new younger generation of Muslims in America.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the immigrant story is a bigger part of the Muslim community than it is in other faith communities. We still have about half of our community being an immigrant community, but there has been a significant shift in the last 5 years or so towards American-born imams. I anticipate that only to grow over the next few years.
And what about numbers? I mean, it would seem that that is not the same kind of challenge when we're talking about Muslims in America who are growing very rapidly.
Yeah, so there are a few reasons why the Muslim community is growing. I think that if you look at the recent ISPU study, Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, on American Muslims in 2017, we do have, I think, a higher retention of young people in the Muslim community, again, because of the continued immigration, which we may see a halt to now, or at least some hindrance to now, has allowed for mosques to really just keep on growing. Islam is still the fastest growing religion in America, so we still very much so have people accepting Islam and converting. Most mosques are running out of space. But I do think that we still face significant challenges that other faith communities do in regards to keeping our youth not only interested, but, you know, fully embracing their American Muslim identity. I think that they're having to negotiate either the Islam part or the American part just because of the political atmosphere.
And what about a supply of young people willing to get the training, to do the scholarship, and become part of the clerical ranks in Islam?
So up until about a few years ago, when that interest really peaked amongst young people, the avenues of studying Islam traditionally in an academic setting in a way that would certify you to be an imam were still wide open. When the Arab Spring took place, you know, some of the prominent Islamic universities in the world no longer are accessible. So a lot of people will still go to South Africa, for example, to study, where there's a, you know, a large number of Muslim seminaries and universities. Some might go to South Asia, but at least the Middle East, obviously, is there's a lot of turmoil. So you've had a lot of seminaries and institutes that have started around the United States because there are so many youth that want to become public speakers or serve in some pastoral capacity. So whether that means becoming an imam, becoming a scholar, becoming a speaker, becoming a youth director, there is an interest amongst many Muslim youth. And so you've had, in just the last decade, you know, tens of institutes and seminaries pop up around the United States.
Let's go to Hollywood, Florida, where Elliot is standing by. Elliot, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I would say that our that my experience as a rabbi thus far, I'm 26 years old, and I'm married and I have two children. I would say that my experience in the clergy thus far has been most similar to the imam who was just on. My community does have a very vibrant, the Orthodox community, the Orthodox denomination of Judaism, has a very vibrant educational system, and many of the congregations, many of the congregants, send their children through those Jewish educational systems, and many of them come out inspired to be a part of the leadership of the Jewish community. I would say that one of the challenges that I've had as a 26-year-old rabbi is not just relating to the people who are millennials and in my age group, but the responsibility to step into that role as a pastor and as a leader, a spiritual leader and guide for older congregants. And, you know, trying to make sure that I'm not overly focused on the people in my age group and making sure that I'm fulfilling the needs of the older congregants in my community as well.
So I hear you saying a couple of different things. It sounds like you're not that worried about demographics, that as a 26-year-old recently trained rabbi, you look out at the 2030s and 2040s without terror.
I would say that that's true. My community, I'm actually on vacation in Hollywood, Florida right now. My congregation is Congregation Avat Achim in Fairlawn, New Jersey. And while we have a congregation that is aging slowly, there are still many families that have children in the congregation. In the broader Fairlawn, New Jersey Orthodox Jewish community, there are several congregations, and many millennials are moving into that area. And so I would say when I look at the 2030s and 2040s, I am, like you said correctly, I am not really worried about the demographics. It seems like the Orthodox community is growing.
Earlier, Rabbi Alpert mentioned that because she's the daughter of Jewish educators, she got a lot of encouragement and people didn't look at her sideways when she announced her intention to become a rabbi. How about you? Were you encouraged as a young person?
I was definitely encouraged by my teachers. I would say that your average member of the community was mildly skeptical. I also grew up in Moscow, Russia. My mother works for the U.S. government, and we were posted overseas for a couple of years. And seeing that difference of the Jewish community in Russia really was part of what inspired me to go into the clergy. And once I had that background and that calling, I would say, it was hard for those naysayers to really have an impact.
Elliot, thanks a lot for your call. Enjoy the rest of your vacation. Mar Thame is joining us now from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for the great conversation.
What's on your mind, Mar Thame?
I'm a Presbyterian pastor who's also a Gen Xer, so I've got some age and wisdom on the folk on the panel. My question is about the institution of religion. For me, I'm a product of the institutional church, and then about a year ago transitioned into a different kind of ministry where I'm a podcaster now. And the question is, what are the folk on the panel doing to reach outside of the walls of their congregations, not to draw people in necessarily, but to have an impact on their communities?
Great question, Mar Thame. Not just waiting for people to come through the doors, but being out there in the world. Father Matt?
So this is our first year where we're really doing a lot on social media, so having a presence on Twitter and on Facebook and on Snapchat, trying to get videos out there about things that are happening in our parish. And we're looking this year to find ways of doing something like podcast or videos so that instead of expecting people to come to our parish for faith formation or for a different type of Bible study classes, to really start beginning to put that out there so that wherever people are, they can receive that information.
Rabbi Alpert?
In my experience, the communities that are the most successful are really serious about at least one thing. So maybe that's learning and maybe that's worship. For us, it's social justice. So our congregation a few years ago decided to invest really heavily in creating a vehicle for the larger Jewish community to be active in movements for racial and economic justice. So now there is a way in Metro Detroit, if you're a Jewish person, you can connect with other Jews who are also passionate about fighting police brutality, about making sure that water is a basic human right. So we do really serious campaign work around those issues, and that's incredibly inspiring to folks across generations. I'll give you a cultural example as well. So every year, Jews celebrate the holiday of Purim, which is a story about Jews being threatened in the Persian Empire and successfully surviving. And in communities around the world, every year we retell the story, and it's a wonderful story. But it's also an incredibly relevant story. And unless we retell the story for our own context, it's not going to draw in people who, you know, aren't especially nostalgic about it, right? I'm nostalgic about it, so I can meet the story on its own terms. But for folks you're bringing in, it's only going to work if it speaks to them. So we had a Purim event where we retold the Purim story, but to be about the school closures in the city of Detroit. So instead of Mordechai and Esther fighting to save the Jews, they were fighting to stop the school closures. And of course, our Haman was was homegrown Betsy DeVos. And it was incredibly cathartic. It was really, really important community building. There were 150 people there. So I would argue that it's no longer enough for us to build communities around geography, or do you like to have guitar in services or not? We actually have to create communities around shared values so that we can together express those values in meaningful ways.
And Imam?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that I've been trying to do, and many of us have been trying to do, is to show people a way of reformation and speaking to people's issues through the lens of religion and through the lens of the text. Our history in this country is that reformers always do come, or not always, but many times do come from a place of faith. And I think that religion still has a lot to offer in that regard. And young people that are trying to find their full identities and bringing all those things together can do so using the text.
Before we go, I wanted to hear from all of you about the future. If this is a country where fewer people are going to be actively religiously affiliated in coming decades, is there something almost comforting about that, because you'll know the people who you look out at from the pulpit really want to be there, that perhaps you will be speaking in a reduced religious community, but one that's more rigorous and one that really desires what you've got to offer? Father O'Donnell?
I think having a community of people that I know, where we're focused, I agree with Rabbi Albert that, you know, to be focused on the issue of social justice at this moment in our country's history, especially with President Trump right now, I think is really important for bringing the community together. And if we really are a community who's more focused, who's more rigorous on why we want to be there in church, then that always sends us back out into the community to make sure that we're using our faith and what we believe and looking to Jesus as the example for us as Catholics and Christians to go out into the world and to make sure that we're making a change, where we're bringing social justice, where we're bringing peace, where we're bringing hope, and where we're bringing love into the world. And so if the community is focused and together on Sunday, then that mission takes us out every other day of the week back into the community to make this world a better place.
If America, Imam, is a place where you can no longer expect or command observance and people really have to want to be there, does that force you to up your game?
Absolutely. I think that people are highly skeptical these days, especially our young people. They will ask more questions than people in the past. What we have to do is to show them how faith can actually offer a fulfillment that not only speaks to their own issues and their problems, but also helps them become better contributors to society as a whole. So we have to highlight an inclusive vision of faith that is true to its tenets. It's authentic, but it also, in this age of individualism, gives me a reason, convinces me as to why I should be a committed follower.
And Rabbi Albert?
Yeah, I have some questions about the premise, because in my experience, it's less about waning religiosity as it is waning willingness to conform or to put up with oppressive conditions or even, you know, just mediocrity. The spinning of the Pew Report makes it seem like the problem is with millennials. And I don't know how, you know, talking trash about millennials is going to make millennials more feel more welcomed. But I don't agree that the problem is with millennials. I think the problem is that our institutions want to be joined by new people while continuing to do things the same way. Young Jews talk a lot about reclaiming Jewish community, reclaiming Jewish practice. One of the callers before talked about alienation. So I think that the jury is still out. I am hopeful that the Jewish community and Jewish institutions can transform so that we don't continue to make the same mistakes that we were making. My generation was not welcomed in their queerness, in their critique of Israel, in their coming from mixed heritage families or being in interfaith relationships. And they were turned off by what they experienced as a gap between espoused and lived values. So I don't believe that there is less desire for Jewish community practice and learning, but less of a willingness to do it on someone else's terms. I believe the next generation is going to remake Judaism in their own image, and we have to be willing to get out of the way and give them our support and encouragement.
From Twitter, Religious institutions are now forced to deal with their contradictions and hypocrisy, and that's a blessing. Adrian writes, not all religion is superstitious, not all reason is free from idolatry. Be wary of absolute statements. And from Chris, I saw a really young priest at Mass on Sunday. His sermon was great. It's good to see that young energy is at the front of the church. Father Matt O'Donnell, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Rabbi Alana Alpert, a pleasure to have you with us.
It's an honor.
And Imam Omar Suleiman, it was great to have you.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the growing call for paid family leave. Washington State just passed it. Ivanka Trump is pushing for it. We hear the debate around an idea whose time may have come. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.